You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, Grant Shapps, Boris, the Greens, Amazon, Twitter Bullies, Radio 4 Comedy, and we review Ballot Monkeys.
Ah, hello everybody. Welcome back to the Parish Council from the Medium Hotel, your favourite podcast of the week. I'm Magnus Shaw, and cymbals crashing everywhere. It's Terence Stackham.
Hey, what's up, UK?
Good girl, wow.
I thought I'd better explain that. You see, I've been looking a lot at Periscope.
Oh, right.
The new app, and every time anybody's running their Periscope from America, they're doing a Periscope thing, and somebody joins from anywhere in Europe, they always say, "Hey, what's up, UK?"
Oh, do they?
When they see that someone's joined, people say, "Oh, hello, I'm watching from Paris." Yeah. And they say, "Hey, what's up, UK?"
Yeah, what's up? That's a very American thing, isn't it?
I can't bear it.
I think it emanated from hip-hop, like, speak, didn't it? That's what...
Everybody in America now speaks as if they're on the streets of the Bronx.
And what's this with the reaching out? Have you heard this?
Oh, no, what's this one?
So I'll reach out to you tomorrow, or...
Oh, Lord.
I'll ask my boss to reach out to you. I mean, instead of get in touch with you.
Oh,
no. That's everywhere. That's everywhere. If you watch House of Cards, which I spend most of my life
doing.
Yeah, it's all over that. So reach out to my secretary, she'll make an appointment for you. That's what they say.
Well, let me reach out to
yeah,
you.
Yeah, please do, yeah.
Sure. Episode 200.
Oh, who yes, here we are.
Is this arrived?
The double century. Yes, it has arrived. How exciting.
That means it's over 4 years since I sat down with you in the leading London media club. Yes. And if I may remind you, I had to persuade you to take part. I said, let's do a podcast.
Yeah, let's take over the world with a podcast. Mm. Yeah, it'll never catch on, I said.
I think he did say something of that nature, yes. Magnus Shaw, 13 days to go. 13 days to go. 13 long days. And I can't help but wonder if all this campaigning and electioneering makes any difference at all. Although there's still time for a Jennifer's ear or a bigoted woman instance.
What was Jennifer's ear?
Jennifer had a glue ear.
Oh, yeah.
And there was some controversy. Was it 1997?
That's
Blair? Yeah. Whether she would get she was awaiting hospital treatment, and there was a sort of delay, and Jennifer's ear was all over the front pages of the press. Yeah, and of course we had the bigoted woman
last time. Yes, yeah. Yeah. No, we haven't had a real pivotal moment. I suppose because we're looking for it, it'll never arrive. If everybody's holding their breath waiting for the defining moments of this campaign, we probably won't get one because we're looking too hard.
That's possibly so. Well, I found so far in the 2015 campaign, nothing seems to impact on the poll ratings of the major parties, not even this week's curious story, the ongoing story, I suppose, of Grant Shapps, the Conservative candidate for Welwyn Hatfield, and the awkward allegations of sock puppetry in relation to Shapps' entries on websites, and perhaps more seriously, the placement of unflattering references to colleagues on Wikipedia. Surely, Magnus Shaw, you agree with Shapps. This must be a Labour and Guardian smear campaign.
No, I don't really. I think he's a catastrophic liability to the Conservative campaign, isn't he? But of course, you can't be getting rid of people at this stage of the game, can you?
Only the voters can do that.
Well, I suppose that's true, yes, and maybe they will, but I think his lords and masters should have seen the writing on the wall when they did have a chance, because he's just stumbling from crisis to crisis, which he then proceeds to, be very flexible about the facts when he's asked about them. But he's just, he really is like something from House of Cards. He's but just not as smart. He's not even very good at covering his tracks, is he? But he really is.
He's the most appalling figure. And I think most amusing is that in his naivety, Shapps is saying. I was just looking at his response to these allegations. He said he can show he was elsewhere when the entries were made, as if you know you can only make changes on Wikipedia by going to their office, you know, with an eraser and a crayon set. You know, I wasn't there. I wasn't caught in the classroom at the time.
Rather worryingly, one of his faux pas was to be running internet training businesses, wasn't it? So how to get rich on the internet, which a subject he seems to know very little about. No, I think, just being politically neutral, I would say the same if he was from another party. More seriously than poking fun at him, he's actually. You know, not the kind of person who should be drawing any money from the public purse, is he? Because he's just he's a liability to himself and to his party, and doesn't seem to be able to tell the truth too often.
Makes me wonder, in all seriousness, how someone like Grant Shapps can get through the political process to the point that they're even nominated as a candidate for a political party, and then. Course, in previous election, actually, you know, voted through by the public, which, you know, makes you realise, and I think we've said this before, that, you know, in safe seats for whichever party, you could put a hedgehog or you know, a donkey up for election, and so long as they're wearing a blue or red rosette, you know, they're in.
Yes, indeed, but they didn't have to make him chairman of the party, did they?
His rise to such a dizzy placement is I just find it inexplicable is the only word.
I can only agree. I think the word reshuffle must be hanging heavy over his head.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? Earlier this week, in his regular column in the Daily Telegraph, Boris Johnson described Nicola Sturgeon from that Scottish National Party as a jewel thief, King Herod, a fox in a hen house, a voracious weevil, and Lady Macbeth.
I did notice online when I was just buffing up on this piece that a clunky typo referred to Boris as calling her a jewel chief, which is something else entirely.
Yeah, well, she could be in charge of the Tower of London, exactly, I suppose, after the election. Boris Johnson, he's most often portrayed as, you know, dear old Boris, there he goes again, you know, he's a real man of the people, he brings us all together, old Boris. But I've long viewed him as a rather unlikable, manipulative blusterer, whose only real interest is the furtherance of his income and power. Which version of Boris do you believe in?
Oh, yours, I think. And I'm very impressed with your demolition of the Conservative Party on this podcast 200. Hats off to you, sir. I couldn't have done a better job myself. But, I think Boris has really built an image and therefore a career on the back of several appearances on How I Got News for You, where people thought, so what a wonderful, you know, funny, eccentric old teddy bear he is. I think it was Rob Newman who pointed out fairly soon after his profile went ballistic that you can laugh along with him and then he'll have you shot at dawn. And I think that's probably sums him up quite neatly. His personal life, and, you know, it is his personal life, but leaves a bit to be desired, his treatment of his spouse and so on. I agree. I think he would have us all shot at dawn, and we shouldn't mistake him for a honey monster. Maybe just a monster without the honey, I think.
By the way, if anybody thinks I'm taking a pop at the right-hand side of politics, I'll be having a good old go at the Greens in a moment.
Oh, good.
So, of course, we have to be aware that if the election goes badly for Mr. Cameron, Boris Johnson could really quite seriously be the Conservative leader in a month's time.
He could.
that in itself.
Is he standing for a seat?
Uxbridge and Hayes. Again, one of those, one would think, a very safe seat.
This would have been a few weeks after he denied point blank that he was going to stand as an MP. I suppose we get what we wish for, because we've often said on this podcast how dull and anodyne politicians are these days, and he is a memorable character, albeit not a particularly attractive one. So I guess we've got what we wished for there.
I suppose so. Also, certainly what the media, in particular television, wish for, because the cameras around him, aren't they like bees to the proverbial honey pot?
Oh, yes, yeah. In fact, I think he probably only looks to Nigel Farage for envious purposes, because he's the only person who attracts more attention mysteriously when he's out and about.
I mentioned the Green Party. The latest opinion polls showed the Green Party being favoured by about 5% of the electorate. So perhaps I should dilute any concern of at some of their policies based on the chances of them reaching power is less likely than finding life on Mars, the Loch Ness Monster being found, or Marlowe Town winning the Champions League. However, what form of madness led the Green Party into the inclusion in their manifesto of an aim to reduce shorter copyright terms with a maximum of 14 years? I mean, this would mean that copies of Harry Potter, Star Wars, Sergeant Pepper, Hunky Dory, Thriller, you name it, could be made and distributed legally with no royalty to the author. This seems a terrific way to alienate their core vote amongst artists, writers and creatives.
Yeah, I think the Greens have fought a terrible campaign, I have to say. They're going to have to pull quite a few rabbits out of quite a few hats to swing this around. The problem the Greens were facing was the notion that they're a bit cranky, you know. Their ideas are a bit bizarre, and they've gone ahead and proved it. I think Natalie Bennett is dreadfully unconvincing as a leader. I've no idea why they switched Caroline Lucas for Natalie Bennett, and putting things like this in your manifesto doesn't help the cause at all. And it's an incredibly reactionary thing to put in a manifesto, and a strange area to focus on anyway. Last time I noticed it, authors' rights over their work, or performers' rights over their work, wasn't a hot potato on the national political agenda. So why tackle that in your manifesto? I don't know. I did look at it in the Greens manifesto, and it's prefaced by the phrase, I'm not quoting verbatim, but something to do with in pursuit of our belief in sharing or something, didn't it? It says that we should all share everything, and therefore you shouldn't have any rights over your works after 14 years. No, I think it's preposterous. I don't know why it was included, but I think it's very typical of a really, really wobbly campaign fought by the Greens, which is a shame, because any party which is outside the two-party, three-party status quo is a good thing, but they haven't done themselves any favours from beginning to end, I don't think.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, she's so woefully out of her depth, Natalie Bennett, that I actually feel sorry for her. And I'm sure that's the last thing that she or any of her team would want is sort of sympathy for her plight.
No, I agree.
But, she's clearly the wrong person in the wrong job. Current copyright law in the UK means that the rights expire after 70 years. It does vary for different types of media, but 70 years seems to be the sort of mean average. And, you know, many people would even argue that even the 70-year rule is unfair, because really, you know, when you think about it, why shouldn't Lennon and McCartney's families or J.K. Rowling's children benefit from the legacy of their parents' work?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we let people inherit houses or businesses. You know, you can leave the your house to your children in your will or anything
well,
you
that's
want.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But you can't leave your composition of a day in the life.
Yeah, your intellectual property. Yeah, I agree. I mean, if your mum leaves you her collection of antique jewellery, it's not like in 20 years somebody turns up at the door and says, "We've come for the jewellery," do they? You know,
exactly.
Yeah, I agree entirely. Yeah.
It's, It's a nonsense rule. Now, no matter how hard I try, I do find it hard to convince you, Magnus Shaw, to endorse the latest technology. You sneered at the telephone mittens I tried to get you interested in.
Oh, yeah, I've gone back on that. I've got a drawer full of them now.
You laughed at the hot chocolate-making socks. And even Amazon drones you turned away from. And it is to Amazon that I turned this week to check if you're signing up to their latest idea. Now, we've got to picture the situation, as we sometimes do. As I want to draw paint a picture for everyone. You and Mrs. the Magnus Shaw order some new seeds, let's say, for your turnip and potato patch, and perhaps some kindling for your fire.
I wish we had one. I do wish we had a parsnip patch. It would be lovely.
Amazon tootle along on their horse and cart, but oh no, Mr. and Mrs. the Magnus Shaw are out. They're not at home. Nope. Perhaps you're getting water from the village well. This is no longer a concern for you because, Magnus Shaw, a pilot program starts in May next month in which Amazon and DHL will deliver packages directly to the trunk, as I say, or the boot, as we say in the UK, of your car. So you simply have your car adapted, as they put it, so that the delivery driver for Amazon has what they call third-party trunk access. And boom, your goods are safely in the back of your car, horse-drawn wagon or scooter. Surely, surely this meets with your approval.
I think you've fallen hook, line and sinker for their line here.
Yes, I have. I think it's a marvellous thing. Yes.
This is never going to happen. This is never going to be rolled out across the world.
God, here we go.
You'll notice in the information that's been distributed about this that at least three, if you include Amazon themselves, brand names are mentioned over and over again in the publicity for this.
Amazon, DHL and Audi.
Audi, exactly. Yeah. Which, of course, is the whole point of the exercise. Is that various tech websites and magazines and indeed major news outlets write a little piece about this. You could say a podcast celebrating its 200th episode covers it. And what happens while they're covering it is they mention those brand names, which is, very smart, very quick thinking from the Amazon's PR departments. But this is not something they're seriously considering.
You're so cynical.
No, I know how these things work. I've been part of these campaigns and, whilst the coverage of the drone delivery that Amazon were banging about, that's all died down now. So they need another story.
I still believe in the drones. I still believe. I suppose I should have seen the warning signs because they do say in the small print that it's currently only available to Amazon Prime members and only if you have an Audi and only if you live in Munich. Yeah. So maybe
do you see?
I should have seen the warning signs
They do it on a tiny scale. It becomes a news story. All parties get some coverage and then it's quietly shelved. So. It just seems like a ridiculous idea anyway, fraught with security risks, I would have thought. So
you always rain on my parade. You pour water over the fire of my dreams.
I'm afraid your Amazon parcels will be arriving the same way they always have, by a callow youth knocking on your door for the foreseeable.
Oh, well, I'm going to go and lock the boot of my car then. I'd glad left it unlocked just
in case. Yes, exactly. Yes. Your car, which is being driven by a stranger around the home counties.
On a more serious note, in the world of technology, Twitter say they are introducing new measures to deal with abuse. And this announcement has followed the recent reports of the TV host Sue Perkins receiving death threats when it was wrongly rumoured, that she was replacing Clarkson in Top Gear. Mm. We know that Dick Costolo, the chief executive of Twitter, has long held concerns about the company's ability to control abuse and trolls. The new measures don't initially seem to be too far-reaching. Twitter are now using software that identifies tweets that might be abusive based on, and I quote, a wide range of signals and context. Do you think Twitter are doing enough?
No, of course they're not doing enough, and this falls down as soon as you give it even the most cursory scrutiny, because for the software to detect the trolling activity, and I have grave reservations about software's ability mm-hmm. to detect, you know, the subtleties of human activity, but the tweet has to be sent for the software to detect it. So it only works in retrospect, doesn't it? And then what you'll have is anybody who's worked for a draconian company and experienced website filters based on algorithms will know how clumsy these things are, because essentially the algorithm will run the tweet against a set of words and phrases in certain constructions and certain orders. But what if you wanted to say, I am appalled that inserts figure's name here has said in their speech, da 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 da. So if you start quoting unpleasant things that people have said, your tweet will get blocked. And this is what happens with these firewalls that you find in offices, where you can't look into, you can't look at a site which is about relationships for young people because it thinks you're looking at pornography, and so on and so forth. And I would say to Twitter, stop forking out money to have algorithms built and start policing your own product with human beings and tackling it. Everything is an abnegation of responsibility. It's like, oh, yeah, well, we ought to be doing this, so we'll get some software to do it. No, tackle it properly. You own the product. It's yours to police. Get on with it.
I wonder if you've got the right target there, because blaming Twitter for trolls and abuse, it's a bit like blaming the manufacturer of biros for poison pen letters, or blaming trees for Katie Hopkins' column in The Sun.
No, I don't think it is, you see, but I think you're giving... I think Twitter, it's different, because you could say... But this is the NRA's argument over in the States, that you can't blame guns for school shootings. But, you sort of can, because, if you promote the availability of guns in a society, then you do have some kind of responsibility for the actions people take. And I think that is true of Twitter.
I believe more must be done in terms of educating people to be more accountable. It's a longer-term view, but people need to understand what they're doing when they're typing their abuse, and to ensuring there are stringent punishments, of course, for this type of abuse. Yeah. You often sort of see... in some of these high-profile cases, it gets publicity, and a police caution, was given. I was like, that's worthless. The police cautions are worthless to somebody who's responsible for this sort of thing. And I advocate heavy financial penalties, restrictions of some sort on internet access, and I don't hesitate to say it, prison. If appropriate. So if, for example, in the case I quoted, that someone, another somewhere, has sent a death threat to Sue Perkins, or indeed anybody, but in our example, Sue Perkins, if I did that out on the street, there would be very serious consequences indeed to me. And I believe the same consequences should apply online. And therefore, if someone has sent a Twitter death threat to Sue Perkins, they should be prosecuted.
Yeah, I agree. And we've mentioned time and again, and I hesitate to mention it again, but I still don't see any flaws in the notion of an internet passport, which allows you, which is required to join sites. And as we've said before, you can use a nickname on that site, but behind the scenes, there is a nailed down confirmation of your identity. And if you start acting the buffoon and you start causing people, worry and distress, then they know who you are. They've got you banged to rights. And if you want to open another Twitter account, having been blocked, you have to do it via your passport, so they know who you are once again. And I'm libertarian at heart, and I don't like the idea of carrying your papers in the street. but I think we gave away that complete liberty to use social media in any way we saw fit when we started, not you and me, we, but as a populace, when we started misusing social media. So I think, you know, you lay down a credit card, it doesn't get charged, but it reveals who you are, and then and only then can you start using the platform. What is wrong with that?
Absolutely nothing at all, but I see a contradiction in your argument there, because your second point means that the need for your first point isn't required.
No, well, I'm saying either way. I don't. Nobody is mooting this internet password, the passport.
But it's the obvious thing. I agree with it fully.
Yeah, yeah.
So you get your internet passport, yeah. And then if you do something stupid, Twitter don't need to have software or a million people sitting in San Francisco monitoring every tweet.
Yeah.
If you step out of line, you lose your passport. No. You can't go on the internet anymore.
Well, that's right. I mean, my first point was, you know, in the absence of something like that, then if Twitter are going to stick their hand up and say, we are going to sort this out, then don't sort it out with a program, you know, because we know that isn't going to work.
But the thing is, Magnus Shaw, I've forgotten off the top of my head how many Twitter users there are around the world, but it's something like 300 million off the top of my head.
Yeah.
How on earth do you expect Twitter? As I say, it's like going into a stationer's and buying a pen and some paper and expecting W.H. Smith to be responsible for what people write on that pen and paper. How can Twitter afford to have so many stuff? It would solve the world's employment crisis, because they'd have to employ about 300 million people in order to track and monitor what people are writing in 300 million Twitter accounts.
Well,
I just don't think your proposal holds any water, because you can't, in all seriousness, expect Twitter to be liable for what people write on their platform.
You could expect Twitter to follow up complaints that people have made about their treatments, which would narrow your 300 million down considerably. And I think the criticism of Twitter thus far has been that the complaints procedure is woefully inadequate and results in no action whatsoever.
I agree fully with that, but even you see that doesn't solve it, because as several high profile celebrity personality people, whatever, have found, if Twitter then say, right, Fred Smith 001 What's Up UK is banned, there's nothing to stop them going into an internet cafe 2 yards down the road, opening up an account under a different name with a different email address, and boom, they're back in business.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. And why, you know, as we've both said in various places, that there does need to be some confirmation of your identity with the service provider. And you know, you can't drive a car or ride a motorcycle without telling somebody who you are. You know, most services which have the potential to cause harm require you to reveal who you are. In fact, you have to reveal who you are to stay in a hotel. So why this should be any different?
Well, I draw the parallel, Magnus, between travelling around the world. You can't travel around the world without a passport.
That's
in some cases, quite stringent visa measures as well, to be sure of who you are and your background, and you know whether you've got a criminal record and so on.
Yeah.
So if you need a passport to travel around the world, then I say in today's environment, the equivalent is travelling around the world on the internet. To travel around the world, you need a passport that confirms who you are, and therefore it relates to how you behave in that country, or on a website.
Yeah, and we're always hearing that the current username password security for any site, including your bank. Security experts are saying that it's all cosmetic, that is no more secure than having no firewall between you and your bank account. It is such a fragile and archaic means of protecting you online that it's almost worthless. So maybe an internet passport could not only protect the people you engage with, but also yourself. Somebody needs to grasp that nettle. I agree. Yeah.
Just to round that up, I mean, I do quite literally mean your passport, because each country has its own system, whatever. But the country that you're you use your internet from could also be equally the responsibility of the country to whom you owe your passport. And therefore, I've got on my passport an individual number, a reference number that is unique to my passport. If that linked to my internet usage, what's the problem? No. None for me, because I'm not going to be sending death threats to Sue Perkins. So you know, each country does that.
Sounds reasonable to me, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to try, you know, I failed abysmally with their getting you to allow Amazon to deliver to the boot of your car. It's clearly not on your radar. No. So I'm going to try something else here. As we recently found with Meerkat and Periscope, the world of apps is a tricky one to conquer. What, one day you're being touted as the next billionaire, the day after you're panhandling at Grand Central Station for a dollar. This week's app to receive the multi-billion valuation is Slack, S-L-A-C-K, which has just received $160 million in an investment-raising program. And it means it's now valued, Slack is now valued as a company at $2.8 billion. Now, many of us might be saying, Slack? What's this?
Yeah.
Who? Slack is described as a team communication tool, and it features chat facilities for companies, enabling private groups, direct messaging, chat rooms. And we might think, meh, you know, and so what? Until we learn that absolutely worldwide major companies, eBay, Sony, Yelp, NBC in America, they are all signed up and using Slack and encouraging their employees to use Slack as a communications tool in their companies. So you're going to be on board with this. I know that the argument might be what happened to wandering over to chat to a colleague or team meetings, but Slack, it's got to be a winner for you, Magnus Shaw.
I don't know. Is this, in what way is this different from an intranet? I mean, I've worked for companies and they've said, oh, here's your login to our intranet, and you can communicate with other colleagues there and look at the staff handbook and book your holidays and all that kind of stuff. In what way does this differ from...
As so often, like Twitter, this is an accidental success in that the bloke is the bloke who founded Flickr, you know, the photography, the image site.
Yes.
Simply wanted to invent, it always follows, doesn't it? Money follows money. But anyway, he wanted to invent a tool, I suppose, that would enable him to chat to colleagues, yes, like an intranet, but with more plugins than a standard sort of email or messaging account. So he wanted services like Twitter, Dropbox, Flickr, so on, all to be available in an in-house communication service. And what this means, and that is Slack, and what it means is that if you and I, God forbid, were working for some multi-international company, we could have private little messages back and forth. You know, say we worked in a big open plan office. I could just send you a message, an instant message, if you like, across to your private company, you know, within the controls of that company, and nobody else would be able to see it. Incidentally, even it's this is the other difference, is that whoever controls the servers, whoever controls the hardware and the software for that company, is guaranteed to have no access to yours and my message. So we could be saying, I hate our boss. I don't like him or her. You know, I can't get on with him. And you can reply, safe in the knowledge that no one can ever read it. Also, you can have group messages, so like a little sort of boardroom thing, or you can have team groupings, and so on and so forth. And that it seems, is the unique difference. Now, to you and I, you might think, but these big companies are absolutely gone nuts on it, to the point that it's been valued this week at $2.8 billion.
Yeah, these internet valuations are usually built on sand, I have to say.
Yes.
I admit that big companies are piling in, and great, the guy is realized his dream of another internet application, his second one. That's terrific, but it doesn't seem much of an elevator pitch. You see, where I always think Twitter succeeded is that you can describe Twitter to somebody in sort of less than the 140 characters you're gifted with when you use the platform. I think that is the simplistic beauty of Twitter. This seems to be, you just explained it to me there. It was quite a lengthy elevator pitch. We've been up to the penthouse and down to the basement several times while that's been explained. But if it's successful, it's successful. But I really get off on internet applications which can be described to me in a few words. And then I'm like, aha, yeah, I see what you're driving at there. And this doesn't seem to be that. And there's nothing in there that makes me go, oh, that's extraordinary. You know, every so often you come across something that's internet driven and you go, that is extraordinary. I think that the Shazam app is absolutely extraordinary. You know, it is like a science fiction film when you use Shazam. You know, it is that extraordinary. And I know it's not strictly internet driven, but I think satellite navigation in cars is extraordinary. It's like being in Blade Runner or something. Slack doesn't have that. That is incredible. It just sounds to me like another social messaging platform. But if it's successful, hey, what do I know?
I don't know if this is an upside or downside, but companies that use Slack report that open offices are much, and I do mean hugely, quieter as colleagues exchange views via the Slack app rather than verbally. So it's hugely popular in, I mentioned earlier, open plan offices. You mentioned it, I think, a week or two, those little hutches, those little mini cells.
In America they have those.
In particular. It's hugely popular in those countries, companies, because the noise level has dropped, some say, by 90%, as people now communicate by Slack.
Now you're working in a morgue then. How wonderful. How that must enhance the buzz of coming to work.
So you won't be introducing it into your workspace, seems to be the outcome
would
here.
Would be rather onanistic, being as I work from home on my own. It would be, yes, I'd be only be messaging myself, really, which would be...
Yeah, it kind of defeats the point of it, I suppose, doesn't it, when you think about it. For years, possibly decades, the cry has been heard across this great nation, and that cry is, why, Magnus Shaw, isn't there any decent comedy on Radio 4? A quick look at the shows generally, all thought to be at least okay, and to many, top-notch Radio 4 winners. Panel shows, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. Launched in 1972, Just a Minute, 1967, The News Quiz, 1977, sitcoms, King Street Junior from 1985, After Henry, 1985, Ed Reardon, launched 2005, and finally sketch shows, The Berkus Way, 1976, Radioactive, launched 1980, Weekending, launched 1970. What do they all have in common? Quite obviously they were all launched a decade or several decades ago. You've been listening to Radio 4 Comedy this week, The Magnus Shaw. Did your choice of listening sound like a Sony Award winner?
I was absolutely astonished, and I'm not the first to raise this. I am aware of that, but I just happened at 6:30. I'm usually away from the radio, but just earlier this week, I happened to have Radio 4 on at 6:30, and I know there's a comedy slot at 6:30, and I know there's been mumbles and murmurs about this particular slot before. I left the radio on. I was absolutely astonished at how poor this program was, badly scripted, badly performed, and most importantly, completely unfunny. Just for example, they had a character in it called, I think, Corporal Punishment. Corporal as in the army rank.
Yeah.
That was one of the jokes. And, that was spotlighted, not only spotlighted, it was signposted a mile off and then delivered to my dismay, some background laughter. I don't know if these things are recorded in front of an audience, whether it's put on later, but there was not a single funny moment in the whole thing. Comedy is a subjective thing, I know, but what it just makes me wonder is there nobody out there with any fresh, exciting, invigorating comic ideas? Well, I think there probably is, but I think the BBC have got the door firmly shut in their face, because instead they are just offering grace and favour spots to people who already have a foot in the door, who are wholly incapable of producing anything funny or entertaining. But as somebody who's written comedy for radio, I've written for radio, but mostly advertisements, so of course I know quality when I see it. but as somebody who's written comedy for radio, what's going on here? Why is nobody reading this script or listening to the playback and saying, this is terrible, lads, you're going to have to come up with something better? Why is that not happening?
Well, I can, or at least on this subject, speak with a bit of insight and knowledge. I quite often work and have worked for the BBC. I even worked on a comedy for Radio 4
last year.
I think that
one was hilarious, by the way.
Indeed.
I have no idea which one it was, but anyway.
Here's the problem, or problems, plural. First of all, I think we need always to look at the BBC as a quasi-branch of the civil service, with archaic promotion processes and a bizarre recruitment policy. And you might say, well, what's that got to do with Radio 4 comedy? Well, I'll try and tell you. Firstly, by the time roles such as head of comedy or head of commissioning, whatever, are filled, they're taken up by inappropriate figures who are woefully out of touch with their subject and their audiences. So the first thing is, you've got people in charge who have no relationship with current trends or what indeed is funny in this respect. I think secondly, the commissioning process at the BBC, and particularly Radio 4, or particularly radio, is now so remote that unless you're a former BBC employee with an iPhone full of contacts to help you beat the system, you have to complete such a complex process followed by an interminable delay before receiving your inevitable rejection that many just don't bother. You can't come up with a great idea, convince someone, and get it made. Those days have vanished.
Now, that's interesting, because I went to see John Cleese giving a talk in London earlier this year, and he described the commissioning process for Python. Him and his fellow Pythons, I think actually only three of them, I think Terry Jones, Michael Palin, and John Cleese, went to see commissioning editor. They said, we've got this idea for a comedy show. It's sketches, but they don't stand alone. They sort of blend into each other, and we use a lot of surrealism, and a lot of things won't actually be funny, but they'll be strange enough to prick interest, and then they'll blend into something which is really, really funny. And the guy said to them, I don't really understand what you mean. Give us 13 episodes. And that was it. They were commissioned.
Well, rather like George Martin with the Beatles, Ian Norton was then given the production direction charge of the Python crew, and there was just something that he identified and thought, as you quite rightly say, sounds okay, let's run with it. Now, I don't say whether that's a better way or not. It seems to be, but for example, back in the late 70s, I used to be able to simply turn up at the writer's room for Weekending on Radio 4, just walk in, say, this is what I've got. If it was any good, it got on the show. If it wasn't, it didn't, and I sold it to the news headlines instead. obviously try doing that now. Another element is the inevitable compliance. I'm explaining why you know, rubbish ends up on that. Compliance. Ever since the Jonathan Ross Russell brand business and subsequent high-profile resignations within the BBC, senior people at the BBC are terrified of a repeat of that and so play it as safely as possible. So no one will take a chance. Hence, you know, they think, oh, corporal punishment. There's nothing there that will upset the Daily Mail.
Sure. Yeah.
I think... As well, you know, we're talking about recruitment and filling the roles at the BBC. Many people that work at the BBC in relatively senior roles are stark, staring bonkers. That's why I say you have to equate it to the civil service, which also has its fair share of, you know, should, you know, people who would really be quantified as lunatics. The mindset of your average BBC Radio 4 comedy producer is as follows. They go to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, see who is getting a bit of a buzz on Twitter, and give them a show. The problem here is that what may work in a 75-seater to an audience of drunk 17-year-olds generally doesn't translate to Radio 4's 6:30 p.m. audience. And... finally, I suppose I call this corporate planning. Many of the successful shows were, like you mentioned, Monty Python, were as a result of one person meeting a producer and convincing him or her of their idea. Now, even if you get through commissioning, and funnily enough, this was highlighted in the first episode of the new series of W1A last night.
It was, yes. I was just thinking that, yeah.
You enter this whiteboard culture of meeting rooms, breakout areas, blue sky thinking, which tends to kill off all creativity before it can walk, never mind run.
Seemingly you have to sit on a sort of a resin-moulded animal instead of a chair.
And that's how we get... Yes, I thought that was great, wasn't it? The little sort of mini ponies that you had to sit on. And that's how we end up with the humourless desert that is Radio 4. Well, because, as you know, that W1A show is treated by BBC insiders as a documentary.
Yes, you can tell as well, yes, which you know, with millions of layers of meta-analysis and irony, is one of the funniest things the BBC are putting out at the moment. So,
But those points I make, that's what leads to you listening to Radio 4 on a random weekday night and hearing the most anodyne, nonsensical, unfunny, absurd piece of 28 minutes that you'll hear in your lifetime. That's my view on how it happens.
Manifestly garbage. It was awful, embarrassing. But at least we have some insight into how it happens now. Soon may it fall, that system, I think.
Last week we took a look at ITV's Newsoids, an allegedly satirical look at the week's news. Incidentally, Newsoids lost a third of its audience from week one to week two, down to 2.5 million on Wednesday.
Unsurprisingly.
However, the upcoming election, 13 days to go, is delivering a cacophony of political and or satirical comedies to our television channels. Tuesday saw the launch of Channel 4's Ballot Monkeys, a five-part series set on the campaign buses of the four major political parties. Were you on board the comedy bus?
Well, I think this was a vast improvement on Radio 4's 6:30 slot. it suffered a bit in its format in that... its selling point was that it's written, you know, right up to the moment they record. And so you could see events that had happened in the campaign being shoehorned into the script a little bit. But it's a good cast, very, very nice cast. And one of our co-podcasters, Mr. Mark Commode, has a rule about comedy feature films, that if it gets six laughs from him, then it gets some kind of big tick as having succeeded as a comedy. And I think this probably just about scraped the six laugh level. It was, it was acceptable. It was funny in places, and had the makings of something really great. But I think because they're writing it right up to the time of recording, the quality filters weren't quite running at full speed. But it wasn't bad, and I'll happily give it a few more chances and see if it picks up. So I think it just about crossed the line, but it wasn't the finest piece of satire I've ever seen.
It was immediately apparent to me that it was a much better script than Newsoids,
yeah.
Andy Hamilton and Guy Jenkin, of course. A strong cast, as you say, Hugh Dennis, Ben Miller. They seemed to come in with a splash, because I found the opening gags were the best, and I think they thought, let's start strong. There was a good Bangladeshi-based gag, which is, when they were going around campaigning, they said, talk to the father because dad always takes care of all the family votes, could be, racist, but I think, even Bangladeshis would say, I identify with that. We're bringing in Danny Alexander to spread the stardust, said the Liberal bus. And I like that line, the notion of Danny Alexander bringing
yes,
in stardust.
Yeah.
The UKIP people said, we've had a quiet day, we've only suspended two people. And the Conservatives, we're bringing in the big guns today. And then, that turned out to be John Major. So I thought that was quite amusing. I very much agree with you that there was clearly no budget required, because it was all filmed on the campaign bus or buses. However, this meant there was almost zero visual content. So apart from the party colours on the bus identifying who was who, it could have been a radio show.
Yeah, that's true.
You had to know. I think the only reason that it had to be on the television was so that we could see which party was being satirised.
Yeah,
otherwise, on the radio, they'd have to say, back to the UKIP bus.
Yeah.
Because it didn't really need it to be on TV.
No, there was a very nice gag where somebody on the UKIP, I think the UKIP bus, was saying something very inappropriate into her BlackBerry, and and the head of communications said, Mal, who are you speaking to? He said, it's all right, it's just my cousin. He said, who writes for the Daily Mirror?
They managed to
nice stuff
with there. That was good, and they managed to react to the tasteless tweet by a UKIP council candidate earlier in the day about the drownings in the Mediterranean, and they managed to get in a reference to that, as you say, that so you can see that we can see that it was filmed very, very close to transmission. I think that format that we're focusing on did, even for a 30-minute show, or indeed a 22-minute show, you take the commercials, it was still probably twice as long as it needed to be, unfortunately. However, as you say, it's a massive step up from that really dismal Newsoids that we watched the week before. It does have, we mentioned W1A earlier, I thought it does have a large debt to W1A and 2012 in that sort of way that, as you mentioned, the UKIP spin doctor, almost grabbing the phone yeah. of the errant UKIP candidate, that it owed a debt to both that and the sort of Iannucci school of writing, which is, to see behind the scenes and, the horrors that people go through to get their sort of product running, as it.
I don't know if you remember, about 10 years ago, there was a show produced and written, I think, by Chris Langham, who had to sort of withdraw from the entertainment business for reasons we won't go into.
Yeah.
But, that was, it's called Cool People Like Us, and
oh yes, yes.
It's in and of itself, it took a lot of cues from the day-to-day and Brass Eye, but it really did set the ball rolling for these spoof documentaries. And the sort of absurd but earnest voiceover which we see in W1A and the way the gags roll out, and I don't think that's recognised, possibly because of what happened to Chris Langham, but it seems to have melted into the annals of history, and nobody really mentions it, but it really did set up that style of comedy, and this seemed to be, you know, a distant cousin of that show. But yeah, like you said,
Sorry to interrupt you, but it's amazing that you mentioned that. I only interrupt because it's very timely. Is that the producer of People Like Us was Paul Schlesinger, and he was one of the directors of, and I know you didn't know this, of Ballot Monkeys.
Ah, there you go. Yeah,
so there was a very, very clear line between the two.
So
a great spot review there.
Well, stylistically, you know, they have a lot in common, and I would say W1A, which we should say W1A at the moment. If anybody hasn't caught last night's episode, Thursday night, is really on fire with this new season. Well, the first episode was absolutely terrific.
But why, Megan Shaw, just on that W1A quickly, is why, oh why, oh why, did they make it a one-hour sort of like a pilot when it's normally in a 30-minute format? I thought, well, you know, that could have been split over two episodes quite happily.
It could, yes, and I sat down expecting it to be half an hour, and suddenly it dawned on me at the 40-minute mark that we'd gone way beyond that, so I didn't realise we were going to get an hour's worth. But I just thought it was terrific. Hugh Bonneville is just delicious to watch, to his credit, you don't spend any time thinking, oh, look, it's the Earl of Grantham. It is like a different actor, and... and of course, this W1A span off the 2012, the Olympics spoof, which was also tremendous. So W1A, for me, appointment television. Really, really good.
Because we've just been talking about Ballot Monkeys. It was good for me to see my old spitting image and Radio 4 colleagues, Michael Fenton Stevens and Philip Pope, involved. So there was including the... People Like Us links. There's quite a history in terms of the people behind Ballot Monkeys. Yes, this was indeed Ballot Monkeys. It was on Channel 4 at 10 p.m. on Tuesday. It is on the catch-up service 4OD for the next 28 days if you missed it. It was written, Ballot Monkeys was written by Andy Hamilton and Guy Jenkin, and directed by Andy Hamilton, Guy Jenkin, Jimmy Mulville, and the aforementioned Paul Schlesinger for Hattrick.
Which is where we put the dust sheets back on the Parish Council episode 200 and wheel it back into the podcast garage for another week. We're off to update our Wikipedia page in order to make it clear we've never updated our Wikipedia page except for this time when, in any case, somebody else did it. As we made clear the last time we updated our Wikipedia page. Yeah, that was a, but first... It's thanks to the magnanimous Terence Stackham for 200 episodes.
200 episodes. What's up, UK? Yes, be seeing you.
Yeah, I'll be seeing you. And a special thanks to you, our favourite listener. Whether you've been with us for one episode or all 200, we couldn't do it without you, and we're glad you're there. There's more at therockingvicar.com. That's therockingvicar.com. Until next week, I'm Magnus Shaw. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to a DACA Media production.